Tailwind Nutrition is a favorite partner of us here at Trail Runner Nation.
Scott, much like a running partner, right? You have a dependable running partner, maybe a dog perhaps, your favorite pair of shorts, your favorite nutrition product.
And it's becoming more popular, a friend of many runners out there, because they're discovering it, they're trying it, they're taking the Tailwind Challenge and finding out that, hey, this stuff works.
It's a game changer.
It is. We're about to listen to another game changer, which is a podcast with Matt Fitzgerald on training the brain. But before we get to that podcast, and we've just had the conversation with him, probably one of my most favorite topics is just the mental side of our game, because so much of it is mental. What we're told, 90% is mental, the other 10% is in your head. And it really is so much of that. And that's what we're going to discover with Matt is that our brain is a central control, and it is, in fact, allowing us to either finish or not finish, and really takes care of us. I've talked about it on other podcasts and other venues about a dashboard full of dials and levers that, as runners, we're constantly moving and changing so that we can finish successfully. Tailwind Nutrition is one of those levers, one of those dials.
It's food for your brain.
Darn right. It's game changer.
So go to Tailwind Nutrition and check out all their cool flavors, the caffeinated berry. There's also Naked.
Caffeinated berry.
Isn't it caffeinated berry?
Raspberry.
Yeah.
So good.
Is Naked, I just have to ask, Naked meaning it is tasteless?
Tasteless.
Mm-hmm. I've got to try that.
Yeah, it's good. Oh, I've got some for you. Let me lend you some. I'll get naked for you, Lee.
Tailwindnutrition.com.
Are we recording?
Dr. Romanoff, you're probably very experienced at professional interviews. This is not one of them.
Come on. Don't put yourself down.
we are very casual. That's a good word.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. I'm Don Freeman.
I'm Lee McKinley.
And I'm Scott War. And today we have, once again, this is his fourth appearance.
Well, there's good reason
on
for
Trail
that.
Runner Nation. Yeah. It's on a book called Brain Training for Runners. We did a podcast not too long ago. Actually, it was back in January about his book, Run, the Mind-Body Method of Running by Feel. And we really liked that kind of thing, and so we went and picked up this book and are diving a little bit deeper into the mental capacities and training the brain.
Mm-hmm. You know, if you took a scientist, an athlete, and an author, and you combined them all into one, you'd come out with Matt Fitzgerald.
A runner that talked a lot on the training run.
Exactly.
about scientific stuff.
That's good. But he brings it to us in stuff that isn't so neuroscientific jargon stuff, as he refers to in the book. He brings it down to our trail running level, which I like.
And if this is the first Trail Runner Nation podcast that you have heard the name Lee McKinley, we mentioned his name many, many times on this podcast. The reason why Lee McKinley is here is because he has a very large brain.
Oh,
one of the few times I've been told that.
He's a master at thinking and analyzing and trying to become a better runner by thinking.
Yeah.
By running less. What can I do to squeeze in a better time?
So thanks, Lee, for attending on this podcast and lending your expertise.
And thanks, Matt, for joining us too. I want to start the podcast by a simple question. You discuss the difference between brain training and I just lost my notes.
Psychological training?
No, shoot.
Mental training?
Mental training and brain training. Right. What is the difference between mental training and brain training?
You know, the simplest way to understand it is that mental training is really something that you do outside the context of your workouts. So things like, you know, visualization or positive self-talk training, stuff like that, kind of traditional sports psychology. Brain training is something that you're always doing. Your brain is being trained every time you go out for a run. Your brain actually adapts to exercise much more readily and profoundly than any other part of your body does. So brain training really encompasses both the physical and the mental part, because that everything meets up in your brain. You know, you can't take a single step of a run until your brain commands your body to move. At the same time, things that you tend to think of as strictly psychological in nature, like self-confidence, all that mental stuff is also seated in your brain. So ain't nothing happening as a runner without your brain's involvement.
Yeah.
I know that the one thing that I liked about the book is you talked about as a newbie runner, there's a lot of things going on in the brain. You're trying to think about your breathing and all these things. And so your brain is actually working harder as a new runner versus somebody that's been doing, you know, the professional competitive athletes that are doing 100-mile weeks. I mean, they go out there and their brain is actually on autopilot, if you will. It's trained. It knows what to do.
Yeah, you know, really the essence of any skill is the ability to perform whatever action it is with minimal mental effort. Think about the first time you ever drove a car. You know, you were probably just, you know, you drive from your parents' home to your friend's house 10 minutes away. And by the time you got there, you were exhausted. You know what I mean? Because you're so new to the whole thing. You're just, you know, you're white knuckling it the whole way. Like every little thing you do behind the wheel, you're hyper conscious of, you know, you're hyper attentive. Now, you know, after you've been driving for X many years, you can drive half an hour from one place to another and not even remember how you got there. You know, you can just tune out and make shopping lists or think about sex or what have you. And that's because you've driven so many times that your brain really can do that whole thing on autopilot. And it's really the same thing with sports and any sport. If you hook up a bunch of electrodes to a golfer's brain, you know, someone who's a PGA level golfer, and they're hitting putts, there's almost nothing going on in that golfer's brain when they're smacking the putts, whereas like an amateur golfer is going to be hyperactive in the brain.
It sounds like I should be a better runner than I am, since I don't have much going on between my ears.
I think I followed a guy who was thinking about sex on the way to the office today. Hey, I've got a question. Right in the beginning, you open up the book talking about the catastrophe model, mm-hmm. about mm-hmm. the heart. How at one time we were thinking about the heart can't keep up with the body, and then we move over to another model. Can you talk a little bit about that to give us a place to launch from as we go into this brain training and for runners?
Sure. So, you know, the opponent in running is fatigue. That's who you're really up against. Fatigue is what limits performance. And for many decades in the field of exercise science, fatigue, there was a sort of catastrophic model of fatigue, as Tim Noakes refers to it. That was the paradigm. And the idea was, you know, you go out and run and you continue until some sort of hard physiological limit occurs. It could be lactic acid buildup in your muscles, or it could be glycogen depletion in your muscles, or you could overheat. Some kind of hard limit is encountered where your body simply breaks down. It's like a mechanical failure, like your car running out of gas. Your car can't magically run with no gas. And the idea was that basically the same sorts of things happen in running or any endurance sport. But it turns out it actually never actually occurs. There's no matter how hard you hit the wall in any type of running event, it's never because your body has actually hit the point where it cannot continue at the pace you desire to continue. It always happens because you encounter a psychological limit first. Your limit of tolerance for perceived effort. That's always encountered first, except in cases of injury or, if you have a heart attack or something, but that's not fatigue. Fatigue is never physical fatigue. A catastrophic physical breakdown is never the cause of performance limiting fatigue in a runner.
So Matt, a question for you about that wall of fatigue. Do I interpret it right from the book that are there two walls then? Is there the brain wall, and then there's the physical wall, and the brain wall you hit that before the physical wall?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So in principle, obviously we do have physical limits, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you could in principle completely you could use all the glycogen, your primary muscle fuel, your most precious and limited muscle fuel. You could, in principle, use it all up. So there's nothing left, and you literally cannot take another step, but that never happens. And so what always happens first really is that you just can't take the pain anymore. You make a voluntary choice to slow down because, you know, obviously as you become more and more fatigued, you feel it. You always feel it. Your perceived effort will increase and increase and increase. And no matter how tough you are, you'll get to the point where you decide, A, this just isn't worth it, or B, like, I simply cannot take any more of this discomfort. And you basically make a choice to slow down or to not go any faster.
You know, that reminds me of, I think, a study that you mentioned in your book. I think it was rugby players, where they took a group of rugby players and they got them on a treadmill. Was it rugby?
Right.
Can you tell us about that study and how they were able to go beyond the wall, even though they thought they couldn't?
Yeah. So this is, you know, there are a lot of athletes that are skeptical of this idea that you never truly encounter a physical limit in fatigue, because it sure feels like you do, right?
Sure.
but that's just it. It's actually the feeling that you do that is limiting in you. So they want proof. You know, okay, where's the evidence that we don't actually encounter these walls? And there's plenty of it, as a matter of fact. And one of it is this one example is the study you just referred to. It was done by Samuela Marcora, kind of a leading researcher in this area. And he took a bunch of rugby players and he put them on. It was actually stationary bikes versus treadmills. And he had them pedal as hard as they could for 5 seconds. So it was like just a max, like how much power can you put out in 5 seconds? After that, he'd done some previous testing. So immediately after they did that 5 second effort, he had them ride at a high but sub maximal intensity as long as they could. So, you know, one of the, they call them a ride to exhaustion. So they're at whatever, 85% of VO2 max. And they were asked to continue as long as they possibly could at that intensity. And when they were no longer able to sustain that required power output, only then would they stop. And on average, these guys lasted for about 12 to 15 minutes. So think of it as like a little lower than maybe 5K race intensity. So they did the 5 second all out effort. Their power output was recorded. Then they did a ride to exhaustion at a high but submaximal intensity as long as they could continue. And they were told that was it. Once they just could not take another pedal stroke at that intensity, they were done. But it was a lie. As soon as they quit, they were asked to do another 5 second all out sprint. And they took the power output in there. So really what they wanted to do was compare the power output at maximum on fresh legs before they did the exhaustive exercise ride, and then afterward. Now, in principle, if these guys had truly pedaled as long as they could at 80% of VO2 max, then they couldn't possibly they averaged about two. Let me put it this way. They put out on average about 1,000 watts in that first 5 second sprint. They were averaging about 240 watts in the second part, where they lasted 12 to 15 minutes. So in theory, if they had hit a hard physical limit, and that's the reason they quit that 240-watt effort, then they couldn't possibly put out more than 240 watts when they were asked to sprint again for five. It's like that would truly be like a car driving with no gas. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they not only put out 240 watts in that second 5 second sprint, they put out 730 watts. So about triple. So it's like, I can't take another pedal stroke at 240 watts. Well, it's just 5 seconds. Oh, well, in that case, 730 watts. So again, that just shows that they quit. It was voluntary. The guys, they didn't hit a hard physical limit. They just quit because they couldn't take it, as tough as they were.
Hey, Matt, may I read a small comment out of your book? I thought about trying to paraphrase it, but heck, I've got your words right here, and you've carefully crafted them for good reason. 25% of the way through the book, I'm on a Kindle app, so I can't tell you what page. It's All in Your Head is the heading. And here's what you state, and I think it fits right into our conversation here. As I stated above, the new brain-centered model for exercise performance argues that fatigue is not an involuntary drop in performance caused by the loss of homeostasis somewhere in the body. Instead, It is an effort by the brain to prevent a dangerous loss of homeostasis by reducing muscle activity and producing feelings of discomfort and loss of motivation. And that, I think that's exactly what we feel when we're out there long and deep into a run, is discomfort. And if that's not enough, lack of motivation, negative head chatter, all of these things start to combine to try to protect our organism, this body, from going into such... We're not horses. We don't run till we drop. You know, so somehow this brain is negotiating with the rest of our body to slow down. It's for our own protection. So yeah. don't make me keep running,
exercise,
Scott.
Exercise is hard for a reason.
Yeah.
So my jump is, and I go back to, I think it was Prefontaine that said, I'm really paraphrasing here, but he said that he could suffer more than any other human, and that's the reason why he could beat any other human, or something to that effect. Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. Is that right, Matt?
It's a good day to suffer. I remember he said that quote.
Yeah.
It's a good day to suffer.
So how do you train your brain to become better so that you can go past that physical limit or mental limit, the first wall?
Yeah.
You know, there's a long list of different ways to do it, because, you know, your entire self is invested in this process. You know, when, you know, it's the same experience for everyone. When you get out there and you really start to suffer, that's the same for everyone. How you cope with that is different for everyone. I mean, there's overlap in the coping mechanisms that people come up with, but it's really like who you are and your personality that will affect, you know, what you come up with. So, you know, it's different for every person. It's just kind of this journey you go on to increase mental toughness. But if you want me to, I think it's important to state that. But if you'd like, I can give you a 1, 2, 3, you know, set of you know, tips for building mental fitness.
Absolutely. I think we're cool. Interested in that. And I know the book is full of it. And I encourage, we're only scratching the surface of what this book offers. So, I mean, it's a must get.
For those who are listening, I mean, the book, the last 2/3 of the book are programs on how you can train your brain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I've shared this with Lee on runs and Scott too, whether they recall, they might've been in their own stage of suffering and so may not recall this, but I've always had a thought about the fuse inside each athlete, that some fuses pop at different mm-hmm. levels of discomfort or you know what they can tolerate, and what size fuse do I have, and what if I had Max's fuse or Lee's fuse and put it in me and we swapped fuses, how much faster could I go if I was carrying Lee's fuse, you know, how come, you know, if I was as tough as he was and I could tolerate more and my tolerance was greater, I think I could run faster, go longer, and all of these things. So that's always been curious to me.
And I think what Matt's telling us here in the book is that fuse that you're talking about is not embedded in the muscle. It's embedded right there in the brain.
Yeah.
And that we can push that back to what you're suggesting, is that we can find ways to push that back so that we know we're not going to die from this, because there are already these pre-barriers set up, but we can push the wall back so we can do something more, something faster.
Can we increase our fuse, Matt? I think that's what we're about to outline in the 1, 2, 3 steps, I hope.
Yeah. You know, it's seriously a very long list of things you can do. Like, let me throw out something totally random that'll just give you a sense of the scope of possibilities. There's pretty good research showing that people are able to, first of all, their perceived effort at any given exercise intensity goes down, and their tolerance, their maximum tolerable level of perceived effort, goes up if someone's just watching them. And if someone's actually cheering for them, it goes up even more.
How about that?
So one thing you can do if you're looking to have the best possible performance is sign up for the New York City Marathon versus the Podunk local marathon with no crowd support whatsoever. Or better yet, if you're male, go to Boston and run through Wellesley College with all the co-eds.
That's very good, yes.
Screaming at you from either side. Or, you know, better yet, if you're running in your area, make sure all your friends and family come out so that you have partisan supporters cheering for you. Like, these things will really, truly make a difference. Sometimes something I even do is I draw attention to a race I'm going to do through social media and sort of, you know, put it out there. Hey, I'm doing this race. I'm trying to achieve this time. And so I know that, you know, in a virtual way, I've got all these people sort of you know, waiting to see how I do. And I'm conscious of that when I'm out racing, and it absolutely makes a difference. Mm-hmm. So that's just one example of something you can sort of, a way you can manipulate the environment you race in to your mental advantage.
Yeah, I want to go back to something that's, I think, a central focus to the book is the feedback loops, three different feedback loops. And after reading your book this morning, I went out for a run, and I decided to cut the run short by a couple of miles just because my body, I couldn't put a pulse on exactly what it was, but it just felt like it was the right kind of thing to do to cut this run short. And I thought that was a good example of a subjective feedback loop. Did I get that right? Is that?
Yep, yep. Absolutely right. And
can you tell us about that?
Actually, to have the discipline and restraint to live to fight another day. Not a lot of runners can.
So how does that tie in? Tell us about those three feedback loops.
Yeah. So your brain is like a hub, as I suggested earlier in the interview. Everything comes back to your brain. But your brain is not the only thing that's going on, right? You've got your body as well, which actually does the running. And as you run, you're receiving, your brain is receiving information, you know, from your body, as you go. Mm-hmm. There's also, your brain is also the hub for information. So there's another feedback loop where, you read my book, Brain Training for Runners. That's a feedback loop where you're gathering information, you're learning about your sport, and that reconfigures your brain. You can take away concepts and then apply them and use that to improve as a runner. And then there's that subjective feedback loop that you were referring to, where you have a conscious awareness of feelings, sensations, perceptions. And again, that's really internal to your brain, but it's a loop in the sense that you can either be mindful or not mindful to all that stuff that's going on. You know, another runner might have gone out and had kind of a flat day like you did and just tuned it out and made it no adjustment, whereas you were mindful of that feedback, subjective feedback, and made a decision.
Yeah, and Matt, let me take that a step further and tell you how the mind did, or my mind was thinking, is that, well, and let's call this the old mind, was that, hey, this feeling that I'm having now about thinking that maybe this is a day to cut it short is exactly the feeling that I should repress if I'm going to be a really good runner, because everybody gets this feeling. How I become better than the next guy, if you will, is that I push through it. Right, that's what I'd been brought up to believe.
That's your old mind, right?
Exactly, right.
What's your new mind say?
And well, the new mind, at least an attempt, would be like, "Hey, this might be a good day to back off. It is not going to impact the long term. Mm-hmm. In fact, it might be better." But I guess the point being, it was a difficult decision mentally at that time, because there's that old brain, if you will, saying, "You know what? This is exactly when you got to push harder."
You've got to learn to trust that subjective feedback loop, you know, to listen to it and know when it's real. And and what I've liked to do is try to identify, why am I feeling that way? What's my sleep look like? What's my nutrition look like? What other stressors am I having in my life that might justify this? I'm trying to validate my feeling and trying to see if I'm just weak now and no longer want to do this, or do I have a real rationale behind it?
Good example.
And so if I can identify it, it gives me some comfort and keeps my confidence level high. Like, no, I'm not out of shape. I didn't lose this overnight. It's just that I have something else that has taken some of my resources away, and so I don't perform as well on this training run. So,
and sometimes you can't identify a reason. You know, you just think, well, I slept well last night. I'm getting along with my wife. You know, my diet's been good. Haven't had to travel much lately, and yet I still feel flat today. And even in that case, 9 times out of 10, experience will tell you, you can still trust it. Your unconscious brain is way ahead of your conscious, and there is always a reason, even if it is, you know, a motivational reason.
That's a great comment. Your subconscious mind is way ahead of your conscious mind. Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. But I'll tell you, Matt, I've never had a problem coming up with a reason. There's always I've got 4 or 5 just ready at any time. Yeah, I've written some on my water bottle in case I'm really low. Hey, let's talk about the objective feedback loop, because that's one of the loops, and that comes in the form of heart rate monitors and all kinds of cadence count and all kinds of fun stuff. Just miles, our pace, just our pace.
Yeah, help us justify our Garmin purchases.
Please. Is it good thing or bad thing?
Absolutely a good thing. You know, let me put it this way. If I took you guys to a track and I said, okay, we're going to run an all-out mile, and I just want you to run as fast as you can, as fast as you can go, and then you do it, and then we come back a week later, and I say, here was your time the last time you were here a week ago. I want you to beat that time. I don't care how you feel. Don't go by feel. Just beat that time. All of you would do it. And you would do it because you had objective feedback. You know, the way our psychology is set up, we're willing to try harder when we're either chasing an antelope or fleeing a tiger. Mm. And those forms of external feedback are exactly that. Competition will have the same effect. I don't know how you guys are relative to each other in ability as runners, but if I had you go off in this mile test one by one, that's one thing. If I had you go off all together, again, you would probably perform better. And that's really another form of objective feedback that's not that different from a Garmin of having pace data. So these types of things can be overdone. You know, one of the reasons that probably the most common training mistake in the sport is going too hard on easy days is because we've still got that pace data on our wrist. And even though we know it's a recovery run and it absolutely doesn't matter how fast we're going, mm-hmm. we still want to put up a good pace. You know what I mean? It's just because it's a performance metric. Mm-hmm. So there's a time and a place to just leave it at home or just not pay attention to it. But there is also times in training when you want to push yourself, and those types of feedback can be really helpful for that. And then when you're racing, you absolutely want it.
You know, it'd be interesting to find out what kind of an impact Strava has had on the running community.
Yeah, yeah.
If people are becoming faster, stronger runners because they're putting up their data and comparing themselves.
Oh, I think you're onto it.
That's a good research project, Scott.
Yeah, right.
For you.
Right.
I'll get on it this weekend.
And I think we already know the answer, too.
Yeah,
it's got to be. And that's why races attract strong runners. They all, you know, like to go run, say, you know, Western States or North Face Challenge or something because they're pushed harder. How many times have you heard, hey, you broke the course record today, but too bad you came in second because the guy faster than you broke the record. So competition pushes competition.
Or how many of us runners say, you know, we love to go out and do a 10K or a half marathon or a 50K because we love to compete. And maybe what we're really saying there is that we're tapping into what Matt's saying, is that being around other people doing the same thing is making us the best we can be.
Mm. Right. Good. Hey, Brain, do you guys have anything more on that?
I was going to make a little note.
The
discussion you and I had about these new Garmin computers we have.
Yeah.
And one of the data points that it has on here is your cadence. And Don came back after the first run with this thing, and he says, I thought I was 180. 180 per minute cadence. Mm-hmm. And he said, I came back and I looked at my thing and I was 172. Yeah, 172.
That's what I admitted to.
Oh, it's really 130.
No, not quite.
But that's another feedback that mm-hmm. will help you become more of an efficient runner.
Hmm. Yeah. Mo Farah's 160. That helps.
Oh.
Mm, oh, all of a sudden.
Yeah, I feel a little bit better.
He just sat up a little straighter in his chair.
Brain training divided into four phases: base phase, build one, build two, and peak. Can we talk about some of that? And I have a specific point that I'd like to talk about in the base that I was absolutely surprised. But I'm going to hand it over to you, Matt, because these are your phases. But I have a question for you about base.
Yeah, so you know, the brain training approach to periodization, which is the art and science of sequencing different types of workouts to get you from point A to point B, from, you know, being out of shape to being race ready. Really, from the brain training perspective, what you're trying to do is start at a foundational level, which is kind of where you are and where you necessarily have to be with your training today. And have your training become more and more specific as time goes on, more specific to the demands that you're going to face in your race. That's what you want to do. About, you know, when it's taper time, about 2 weeks before your big race, whatever it is, you want to be doing workouts that, you know, aren't as hard as what you're going to face on race day, but are pretty specific to it. And then the more you back up from there, the less specific your training is, but you're coming at it from two directions because there's more than one component to training. There's sort of a raw endurance component where intensity is low, duration is high. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning of training, really, really slow is good, and gradually building volume is good. On the other side, very, very high intensity, like sprint type stuff, power type stuff. Again, that's extremely non-specific to a marathon, say, but that's the time to do it. Actually, at the very beginning of the training process, and the more you go on the high intensity side, you want to make those high intensity efforts both longer and slightly less intense, so that your interval workouts actually become more and more, closer to not completely specific to something like a marathon, but more and more so. And then what these two types of training are doing is converging as you approach your peak fitness time.
Matt, I just have to ask, did I hear you say high intensity in the base training?
Yes. Yeah, that's.
Tell me more.
Well, I mean, that really is the time to do it. And, I guess, I don't know, maybe it does sound crazy, but this is what a lot of elite runners do today. If you go back to Arthur Lydiard's time, it was base training meant all low intensity all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was actually revolutionary at the time, and Lydiard's runners did great, but a lot of time has passed since then. And sort of some limitations with the Lydiard approach were discovered. And one is, if you ever completely eliminate really high intensity training from your training, it's really risky to add it, you know, because you've lost all that. You've lost all those adaptations, and there's never any reason to just give that up completely. So you should always be doing some very, very high intensity work. It's just that at certain times you don't want to be doing very much of it, just sort of a maintenance amount of it. But the thing is, like very short intervals, like, you know, 10 seconds, 20 seconds at almost all out, that's actually not very stressful. So it's actually, it fits pretty well in base training because you get a lot of bang from it. It sort of keeps your maximum power output, your fast twitch muscle fibers well engaged. But it really doesn't take that much out of you because you only have to do a bit of it. And that's why, you know, counterintuitively, it actually, base training is a pretty good time to do that type of stuff. Hmm.
Put that way, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so that was my exact question about, and I'm glad you asked it.
Yeah, right, Don.
No, it was, Scott.
I had a feeling. That's why I jumped in.
No, but for my understanding of reading the book, and please redirect my comment if it's way off base, is that the difference between some of the athletes, the faster athletes compared to the folks that aren't quite as fast, is the ability for the brain to recruit a number of muscle fibers all at once to make speed happen or power happen. Mm. And the only way that you can actively recruit a great number of muscle fibers is to actually at some time recruit those muscle fibers. So if you're just strolling around and slogging along all the time and only requiring a small percentage of muscles to fiber to fire, then when you really want it for speed and endurance and performance, you may not be able to recruit them and they're not there. Is that yep, somewhere along the lines of what I was trying to read?
Yeah, it's kind of a version of use it or lose it. It's, in this case, it's use it or you'll never gain it in the first place. You know, that ability to, you know, there are two ways to do it. One is, you know, if you want to develop fast twitch muscle fibers, you can sprint or lift weights or, you know, do plyos or whatever. Another is to actually go for a very, very, very long exhaustive run that tires out all your slow twitch fibers so that there's nothing left but fast twitch muscle fibers, and so there are two different ways to do it, and they're both beneficial.
You know, I don't know, this is somewhat related, but talk about plyometrics and brain training.
Yeah, so plyometrics are, if you're not familiar with the term, it's basically jumping exercises. Just imagine a small platform like an aerobic step in front of you. You're standing on one foot, you're jumping up on top of that platform and then back down to the floor. You would think, okay, you know, maybe, you know, that sort of exercise can be beneficial to a runner because it increases your power output. That's not actually really how it works. There's plenty of research showing that adding plyometrics to a run training program enhances performance, but it actually does it not by making you more powerful and sort of increasing your top end speed. It actually makes you more economical, and it makes you more economical by increasing what's known as leg stiffness. That's actually a scientific term. So, you know, when your foot hits the ground, when you're running, your joints collapse to a certain degree. And you want them to give a little bit, but you don't want to give them too much, because what your body is doing is actually capturing energy from the impact with the ground. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's sort of like, you know, a spring type effect. So your knee flexes a bit, your hip flexes a bit, your ankle does, and then you stop and you've captured that energy. And then when you spring back off the ground, a lot of that energy, up to half of it, is free. It wasn't even produced by your body. It was just captured from the ground and it's reused. So typically a runner who's not as economical as they could be is lacking in leg stiffness. Their leg is like a wet noodle, and it's just, you know, all that impact energy just goes right through the body and is lost. So plyos will actually make your leg stiffen up a little better on impact, so you capture more of that free energy and can reuse it.
A tangent of that, didn't I read in the book where there was a recommendation, I think it was in chapter one, when you talked about how you were perceived as quite different than other runners out there, and one of the things that you do is in the middle of a long run, you will do jumping jacks. Is that right?
Yeah.
Did I catch it? Is that tied in with your discussion here with Scott?
Yeah. So, not jumping jacks. At least I hope I didn't say that.
So I was speed reading.
Yeah, I will do drills. I'll incorporate, because, you know, I'm like anyone else. I'm like, who's got time for this? You know, yeah. I have to add another kind of training. Sometimes I just don't want to make a separate workout or a separate session for drills or whatever. So yeah, I'll incorporate them right into the run. Just simply running on one leg, i.e. hopping, that's plyos. So when I'm out on a run, I'll do 20 strides hopping on my right leg. I usually make sure that no one can see me before I start.
Go out early in the morning, in the morning.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, 20 strides on the left leg, or, you know, so it just, that way all that stuff is incorporated right into the run. I don't have to find extra time for it.
I don't mean to get too far away from our four phases of this brain training, but back to the brain actually controlling the muscle fibers. I just want to make a comment that you said, monitoring and controlling running pace and intensity, that the mind has the ability to recruit as many muscle fibers as it needs, but can decrease when it needs to slow you down because of heat or other metabolic things that are happening. All of a sudden, this feeling of weakness and fatigue we have is real. The mind has shut us down and put a governor on our ability to produce power.
You can go from an 8-cylinder to a 6-cylinder.
Yeah, in some cases, a trailer.
Yeah, you know, that's actually that's sort of a hotly debated area in this whole field of research right now, whether the reduction in power output, or yeah, I guess reduction in muscle activation, actually occurs mechanistically without you're able to make a decision at all, or whether you actually are always choosing to slow down. There's a Tim Noakes camp. He's the guy who, you know, wrote the foreword to brain training and came up with the term central governor. He believes that it's a mechanistic thing, that, you know, sometimes you don't get a choice at all. Your brain, just on a completely unconscious level, receives, you know, red flag feedback from your body and shuts things down. Samuela Marcora, a guy I mentioned earlier in the interview, who's in the other camp, says, no, you know, that's a homunculus argument. And, you know, it's not a true, it's explaining it away. You know what a homunculus is?
I'm Googling it.
Little man inside the man. So when you're trying to ask questions about why why things happen, you just it's a non-explanation, basically. So Marcora believes that it's always voluntary. When you even, you know, when you're 20 miles into a marathon and you so badly don't want to slow down, and yet you're slowing down, and you would swear, this is not voluntary, I am not intentionally slowing down. Mark Horace says, yes, you are.
Well, that's a great philosophical debate. I think you're given the chance to slow down, and then if you don't, then then Dr. Noakes is correct and your body shuts itself down. So I think they both camps have a good fight.
That's right.
Yeah.
Building phase. We've got the base. We know it's good to do some aerobic training and it's okay to put in some strength training with it and some anaerobic work. Now, what are you doing in your build one and build two phases?
That's when you're making additional steps toward specificity. So let's make it specific to keep going back to the example of a marathon. You're training for a marathon. So in those four phases, sort of your first phase is you're completely at the extremes. Everything is either really slow and prolonged or, you know, really fast and short. And in the first build kit phase, it's sort of like you go into 5K training. So you're sort of climbing the ladder toward where you want to be, or really you're sort of in 5K and ultra marathon training at the same time. So you're coming from the extremes and heading toward the center. Mm-hmm. So it's actually like if you're taking this brain training approach and you are training for a marathon, it's actually not a bad idea to plan a 5K at the end of build one and a 10K at the end of build two, and even a half marathon as your last big race before the marathon, because in the earlier phases of your training are actually more specific to those other distances. So you can take advantage and hopefully pop off some good races at shorter distances.
Lee, you've done that. You've been one to sign up for 5Ks and 10Ks on as you prep.
And not really knowing that it was any good for me. I just actually thought that I might have a chance to get a win at a small race.
And probably one of the most elusive things, at least for me, is this peaking thing. I think I peak when there's never, you know, I don't have a bib on. I'm sure I'm peaking on that day. Yeah. And when I'm not training with anybody else, I'm probably peaking on that day.
You're peaking when you're going past the girls' college is what you were doing.
Oh, Scott. So help us with peaking.
Yeah, peaking, actually, there are some who believe that it's primarily a psychological phenomenon, that the closer you get to race day, the more motivated you are to go to the well, to go to the wall. That's not so much the case with beginners and people who are starting at a low fitness level. In that case, you know, as you're training for a race, you are truly getting physically fitter and fitter and fitter to the point where, you know, eventually the idea is to get to a point where you're handling the heaviest training that your body is ready for at this time. Then you cut back, taper and hopefully have a peak performance in your race. If you're more experienced and you're actually at a fairly decent level of fitness at the start of the training process, physiologically, you're not going to get all that much fitter over the course of the training. All you're really doing is getting mentally readier and readier to dig deeper and deeper psychologically. So like there was one study that was done with Division One college runners, where they were in a cross country season, and they were subjected to physiological testing at various points from the very beginning at, you know, the end of summer until just before their championship race, and the physiological testing came back with no changes, the results were the same all the way through, and yet their race times got faster. Because they were actually, it just their whole mental approach was like, you know, well, in September, hey, it's September, no biggie. You know, I don't have to completely carve myself hollow. But then when November and December rolled around, it was time for championship races. You know, maybe they were marginally fitter, or their fitness was marginally more specific to the 10K race distance or whatever. But most of what made the difference in their race times was that they were just ready to go. They'd had 12 weeks. You know, where they knew when they had to be at their best, and they just made sure that they were.
That's the amazing thing, you know, the brain, how much influence it has on outcomes. Because if the brain wasn't involved at all, we could just take people and put them through, get your heart rate, get your VO2 max, and, mm-hmm. you know, figure it all out, and then place the runners or the athletes in the order that we would anticipate them finishing based on these physiological tests. But in fact, it's not the case at all. You have to go out there and race to find out who's going to finish first. And all of these objective matters are really just incidental and interesting, but not predictive. You know,
I just came back from a trip to Spain. I spent a few days with the Lotto Jumbo professional cycling team. It's a Dutch team. They're in the Tour de France every year. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they actually, while I was there, they underwent one of these big physio. It was the big first big testing day for them in the 2015 season. There were 16 guys there. They were doing this brutal workout, you know, and getting blood lactate samples and heart rate and power data. And one of the coaches showed me the results, and I could see, you know, who had the best results, who had the worst. And then he told me, like, actually who the best racers were and the ones who underperformed. And it was a completely scrambled version of that list. It's like the testing, it told you they were all elite cyclists, but that's it. And that's all you can really get from it. Cause you have gamers, you know, those people who just live to compete and show up with something on race day that just isn't in the tests. And then you have workout warriors, the people who just crush it in training, and then, you know, they just disappoint on race day.
Hey, I want to go back to that mid training phase and something that I read in the book about how you like to, when you're training for a race, you like to get in a couple of pre-races leading up to that where you just, my words, not yours, but you want to just crush your body. You yep. want to make yourself suffer like you haven't before. And, well, can you tell us how that benefits us when it comes to the actual race day that we're shooting for?
Good question.
Yeah. Yeah, well, a couple things. Like, you know, it's almost like, you know, public speaking, where we all get nervous if we have to speak in public. But if you've never done it before and you have to speak in front of 1,000 people, you're wetting your pants. If you've been speaking almost weekly for 10 years and you have to speak in front of 1,000 people, you know, you're not nearly as nervous, and you can, you don't have that same level of performance anxiety. Well, suffering, enduring high levels of perceived effort is very similar. You can inure yourself to it. So if you've never done it, you know, I remember the first kind of endurance race I ever did. I was like 11 years old. It was like a 1 mile field day race in elementary school. And I just couldn't believe the sensations I was experiencing, you know, because kids race, but they race 50 yards. This was a mile. I'm like, oh my God, like, am I dying? You know, it's that intense, you know, that's what this sport,
sure,
you know, levies. And so those sensations, you have to practice at them, and you do get better at it. And you fine tune, you become, talk about feedback loops, you become more and more sensitive to what you really can push through and what you can't. So, you know, experience helps, but also, you know, even as an experienced runner, you can get out of practice. So, you know, you finish the 2014 season with your last race, you have a nice off season, then you start training again for the 2015 season, and you haven't raced in a while, and you've sort of forgotten how to suffer a little bit. So what I like to do for myself and with athletes I coach is actually have them do a first, usually a short race, pretty early in the ramp up for whatever the next peak is, mm-hmm. just to suffer, just get out there, run a terrible time and just suffer a bit. And often, usually what will happen right after that race, their training goes up a level, just like, it's just one race,
yeah.
but just their, it's like a recalibration. Their brain is like, all right, okay, I see.
That's we haven't
retired
point.
Yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can I add to that? And, yeah. It may or may not be accurate, but just pre-race jitters. If you haven't raced in a while, you're burning a lot of extra unnecessary energy.
And
just
stress
getting ready for that gun to fire. And if you've gone out and have done that race and practiced a few, it's got to preserve some of your race energy.
Yep. You know, there are different styles. You know, I think we can all think of, you know, examples of elite athletes who they race very infrequently. And they don't like to show up unless they're ready to kill everyone. You know, just that, you know, it's like the bodybuilders who lift it, who they train in heavy sweats until, you know, 3 days before a bodybuilding show, and then they rip the sweats off and they're like, look at me.
Yeah.
is that what you did, Don? Is that what you did?
That's what I did. That's why you haven't seen me out of my heavy sweats in a while. I'm ready though. Any day now.
Any day you're gonna rip them off.
Yeah.
Right.
Hey, so I think this is related. It's a word that I had to actually slow down and sound out because it's so long and complicated. Teleoanticipation.
I wrote it down, Scott. I wanted to go
Talk
there too.
Talk to us about teleoanticipation.
I just like saying it. I'm glad you You brought it up.
Did I say it right?
That's how
word of the day.
I've got good news for you. That word is kind of out of favor now. We've got a new.
What, better?
Oh, okay.
It's actually more of a mouthful, but it's more familiar. It's regulatory anticipation.
Regulatory anticipation. All right. Uh-huh.
Making a note.
Uh-huh. Actually, no. It's anticipatory regulation.
Anticipatory regulation.
Right. I like it.
That was my moment of dyslexia. So telio anticipation didn't quite catch on, but it's the same concept. And basically it's pacing. When you start a race, say, and you're planning to get to the finish line in the shortest amount of time possible, right? That's the goal. If the race is going to last anything longer than 30 seconds, you cannot run at maximum intensity at any point except when you're within sight of the finish line, right? If it's a 30-second race, a 20-second race, you can start out at maximum intensity and hang on. If it's any longer, you have to hold back, because if you start a 5K race at a sprint, you will be walking after 500 meters or so, right? So that's where pacing comes in. You have to hold back, but you don't want to hold back too much. You want to hold yourself back to the fastest pace you can sustain until you reach the finish line. Well, how do you do that? By feel, primarily. And that's what regulatory anticipation is. Or, you know, I honestly can't remember if it's the one or the other now. Someone Google it while
I'm working on it.
You brought up a study that they did with that, where they took some good elite running athletes and they said, run six different sets or repetitions or something like that. So I'm going to try to get it close, but the theme will be there. And the challenge was for each one of these athletes to duplicate their time, so that although they're running consecutively these laps around the track, the goal was to try to finish in the same amount of time. And they were using this anticipatory regulation.
Anticipatory regulation is the correct word.
Mm-hmm. They must have been using that to somehow pace themselves to get around that track in the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Feedback. It's just sort of like a built-in aptitude. One of the leading researchers in this area is a guy named Carl Foster. He's at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. And what he's found is that if you present people with sort of a novel endurance challenge, say it's a simulated 5 kilometers on a bike, finish the work as fast as you can. If the subjects have never done it before, usually they're really conservative the first time and they just go kind of slow. And then the next time they go a little faster, the next time a little faster, mm-hmm. They're not getting fitter. They're just familiarizing themselves with the task and learning what they can handle, basically how much perceived effort can they endure for the amount of time they have to endure it in that type of challenge. And if they go beyond 4 tests, they stop getting any better. So usually it takes about 4 tries, no matter what the task is, and you've kind of nailed it. Of course, you can fine tune for the rest of your life. I don't think anyone's ever completely mastered 100% the art of pacing. That's part of what keeps the sport exciting. But that's it. It's just like and what's happening is that if you have knowledge of how far you have to go and you are aware of how you feel, you're basically making micro adjustments to your perceived effort level. The idea is like, I'm running a 10K, I'm 2K into it. How should I feel 2K into a 10K? You're not having a conversation with yourself, but if you've done it before, you have a sense of how should I feel at this point. If you feel worse than you should, you're probably going to slow down a little bit. If you feel a little better, then you're going to speed up a little bit, and you make these micro adjustments. And of course, you keep closing and closing the distance. So your brain is making these calculations second by second, over and over until you get to the finish line.
Wow.
Yeah, should my quads be locking up like this?
No.
Maybe that means I should slow down.
You know, I know you had a question, Lee, but I have a little comment here. I just remembered this was probably 3 or 4 years ago. Don and myself and Julie Fingar, we were running late one night, and we were running from point to point. I don't know if you remember this. And I can't remember if it was you or Julie got mad because we thought
Julie.
Julie got mad because we thought we were stopping at a certain place.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And before we got there, we were probably halfway through the run, I think it was you, Don, you threw out, no, we're going actually this much further.
Yeah, that made her angry.
And made her very angry because she had in her mind at the beginning of this run, I'm going from here to here, and use this anticipatory regulation to, you know, adjust her pace to go from point A to point B, and now she finds out she's going to point C.
Yeah, she was not happy with that. Here's another example, Lee, that you and I have done that I always think back on. I really enjoyed it, is when we were doing those 800s. And you would take the first 400, and then I would take the next one. We'd use the watch, and we'd see if how close we could get to reproducing the same time. So whatever the first guy did in the first lap, that became the goal time. Mm-hmm. And then I would take the lead, or vice versa, and then our goal was to try to match that time. So it made a game out of it, made it fun. Mm-hmm. And
it's like horse.
Yeah.
Sure.
It was a fun thing to do.
Until we started throwing up.
Yeah.
You should have started a lot slower.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you have Lee go first. anticipatory regulation, and you also have something going on out there called PAIR, a way to have some input as we're running. What are you doing with that, Matt?
Yeah,
the website.
PAIR Sports, that's PEAR, all caps, sports, is a smartphone app for runners and actually other athletes. It's a cool concept. There are a million devices out there where you can get information or data about your running. This one's a little different because it's actually coaching you. So you go out with your phone and ideally a heart rate monitor strap and earphones. You've selected a workout and you'll actually hear a real human coach, there's Jenny Hadfield. There's, a whole list of coaches, most of them with familiar names. Dina Castor is one of them. Mm. And you're coached through a workout. So say you want to do a marathon simulator run about three weeks before running a marathon. You'll go out and be guided step by step through audio, my voice in your ear through the headphones. Just as if I, you know, you had hired me to ride a mountain bike next to you while you do this workout and, you know, tell you the purpose of the workout, what's coming up next, whether you're running too fast or too slow, reminding you to hydrate, giving you form tips. So it's not for everyone, you know, not everyone wants to run with a smartphone or feels they need that kind of hand holding, but, it's really popular and getting more so, and I dig it.
And consider it an alternative to coaching?
Yeah, it is. It's like the next best thing. You know, I can't be everywhere for everyone, I'm afraid. But with PAIR Sports, it's almost as if I can be. You know, it really does. Because a lot of the technology out there, it's very kind of, it's like how the computer coaching you. But this is a really more of a human-to-human solution. You really do feel like, you know, you've got a person, you know, actually coaching you through the workout versus just a bunch of, you know, cold, hard data coming at you.
And how does the heart rate monitor interact with this mm-hmm. coaching process? Mm-hmm. Is it taking some of the data in?
Yeah, so the first time you use it, there's like a 20 minute, it's basically a do-it-yourself lactate threshold test. It relies on perceived effort versus you don't have the smartphone taking blood from your finger or anything.
Yet.
Yeah, right. I was just thinking that.
So you do this 20-minute assessment run, and you don't have to do anything except start the workout, and that's it. And then you hear my voice guiding you through it. And by the time you've completed the workout, the app has captured your lactate threshold heart rate and used that to calculate 5 custom target heart rate training zones. And then the app knows them. You don't
that's
even have to
cool.
know, you never have to know them yourself. Mm-hmm. And then every subsequent workout you do will be tailored to your zone. So you know, there are 5 different zones. Mm-hmm. And if say you're doing a tempo run, which will target zone 3, the app knows what your zone 3 is. It could be 152 to 160 beats per minute. So when your coach asks you to go in zone 3, if you're above 160, your coach will come back and say, hey, you're a little bit above zone 3, slow down just a little, that type of thing. So
what a concept.
Or, come on now, Don. Suck it up.
Yeah,
suck it up, Buttercup. Let's get
guys,
moving.
There's a bit of that. I get loose in some of the workouts.
So, in some of the coaching that you do for athletes, do you incorporate this app as a component or as a tool of the coaching that you
do? Yeah, I always offer it as an option. Again, it really isn't for everyone. Some people just say, no, I will never run with a phone. Don't make me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a good tool. And some people just use it for the more complex workouts. You know, like say you're doing like mixed intervals. So like you've got different durations, different distances, different target zones. And, you know, if you have that all on a piece of paper, you got to leave the piece of paper at home, right? And you could get halfway through your workout and you're like, all right, was it 30 seconds in zone 4 or 40 seconds in zone 3? But if you've got, you know, the workout with you on your app, you're just listening and doing what your coach tells you to.
I think that's good stuff because it gives you some motivation, and it doesn't have to be every single workout. You could throw it in there when you need a little extra or need a little coaching. So I think that's great. Scott, you're linking that app or that website.
Already done.
I figured you did.
I've actually downloaded the app already.
Oh, what zone are you in right now?
12.
That's good.
Well, Matt, thanks for joining us. Matt has like 22 books out. You can go to his website, Matt's Fitzgerald, mattfitzgerald.com or Amazon or
.org. Some other clown got .com.
It is. Oh, well, I put .com and it came up correctly.
Really?
Oh, no, it didn't. You're right. It didn't. It came up wrong. Yeah. And then I just put in Matt Fitzgerald and it took me to the right place.
There you go. Yeah.
So we'll link it for those of you who can't remember. It's .org.
Man, I do think you're on the cutting edge of every time we come across the book, it is like, yeah, no kidding. This guy is right on the money, just exactly.
Good trail talk, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, and give us an elevator speech about your newest book, 80-20.
Yeah, so 80-20 running really addresses, I think I referenced it earlier, the single most common mistake and costliest mistake that runners make in training, which is doing their easy runs too hard. You know, just it's remedial stuff, but sometimes it's the simple things that we get wrong. So 80-20 running, the idea is 80% of your training should be at low intensity, 20% moderate to high.
I just have to ask there, how does that book or does that book complement brain training?
Go ahead and finish your question.
Well, I've read both, and honestly, I was a bit challenged to see them. I saw them as two very separate topics almost, and it's probably something missed by me, but tell me how they complement each other if they do.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, I would be lying to you if I said that they are, you know, I don't know. I mean, they're different. They really are different. And because, you know, my thinking evolved. So brain training I wrote in 2007, 80-20 running in 2014.
Oh,
so, okay. You know, I've learned some things since then. If you went through the training plans, actually I've done it myself in brain training, you would find that actually they do conform to the 80-20 principle. About 80% of the training is at low intensity in those training plans, but the periodization is a little different. We spend a lot of time on it. The plans in 80-20 running are actually a little bit closer to the older Lydiard model. And the reason I went that way is that I have found the brain training approach gives you a little bit more flexibility to kind of race more often or to race when you want to. You're kind of always in shape. You're always like not that far away from being able to bust out a good performance. What I have found is if it has an Achilles heel is that runners are more likely to overdo it to overtrain or get injured with the brain training. Whereas with the more of the Lydiard 80-20 approach, it avoids those risks a little better, but you don't have quite as much flexibility to race whenever you want. So, you know, nothing's perfect, and I'm very forthcoming about that. But, you know, they're different flavors, but also, you know, not as different as it may appear on the surface.
Well, I appreciate that, Matt. Thanks.
Well, the good news is the brain hasn't changed much since 2007. So I think we're in good shape, and it applies. So you speak about when you open up the book, you say, you know, the heart, the muscles and the brain, they're all important. Running isn't just your heart or just the muscles or just the lungs. The brain is right there, part of it. And we can't ignore it. If we want to become athletes and perform at our best, then you have to address one of those three legs that we stand on, and that is what's happening above our shoulders. So I really like that book.
Amen.
Yeah. hey, we want to let the Nation members know that actually, they'll hear this podcast before it happens, but we are launching our new website hopefully this weekend.
So we expect the infrastructure of most web and what is that, bandwidth, to all of a sudden drop in cities because people are busily downloading and looking at the new pages. And so if you hear about that phenomenon, you'll know it's us.
It was all Trail Runner Nation's
fault. Exactly.
Yeah. So go out and run.
Mas.